top Fox News headquarters in New York City. Always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
So glad you're there. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show coming your way. A very important show, fresh off the, sadly, historic White House Correspondents' Dinner for all the wrong reasons. This hour, I'm going to be joined by Natan Levy. He's an Israeli UFC fighter, so it's good to have him in studio. And as is Lawrence Jones, who takes jiu-jitsu, unrelated. We can't get you into an octagon, right, Lawrence?
What an interesting fact that you just brought up.
But is it true?
It is true.
So don't back to
I will get into an octagon, though.
I totally would. But, you know, the whole thing of being kicked in the face, it's not good for your career. It would
hopefully,
have to be a guy who's had
maybe some vacation time, sick time.
We already had a situation with your eye.
I know. We don't need another one, right?
Yeah, but you're back training. That's
crazy.
I'm
back training, 100%.
Did you wear the Kareem Abdul-Jabbar goggles?
No way. No way. But the thing is, it's like there's no striking. Now, if I was still doing Muay Thai, yeah, I would need to.
I heard it was Muay Thai.
No.
It's Muay Thai?
Muay Thai.
Oh, I said Muay Thai.
Muay Thai.
No wonder I'm not good at it. But that is all kicking, right?
Yeah, it's
there's
kicking.
There's not no grappling.
Striking, a lot of striking.
But there's no grappling.
No grappling.
Right, you go to the ground, they let you get up.
Yeah, you pretty much get up. To do UFC, you need two disciplines. Like normally it's jiu-jitsu and Muay Thai or kickboxing or boxing, you know?
I'm thinking I would have arm wrestling, thumb wrestling.
Right.
And those are two. How would I do?
What a level of defense.
He arm wrestled, thumb wrestled. Brian Kilmeade steps into the ring.
I will say you stood tall at that event. So whatever you're doing, right. You got a heart of a lion.
Well, because I don't have your training to know where danger is. But Lawrence is talking about he was diagonally over from me at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. We had the Fox area. When all the shots ringing out, one of the few that I can identify shots and not trays because of your experience.
Yeah.
And just crazy. It ticked you. I find that you are more angry.
I am very angry.
Than most people are not as angry as you.
I'm very angry about this. And it's funny that you know that about me. Because I try to be measured in most of this, especially when I'm supporting law enforcement. But they're just clear, present failures. And you know what ticks me off, Brian? When a mistake happens and you don't learn from the mistake. This is number three.
Right.
Okay? And I'm still seeing the same failures that I talked about the first time happen again. And you know who else is upset? I don't want to overstep, but the family's not happy. The Trump family is not happy. The president is
being supportive. I heard Susie Wiles is not happy either.
She's not happy either. And something has to give. Something has to give.
Well, you remember Sean Curran? He was the one who covered the president.
A great guy.
He's now in charge.
He's in charge. And some of the same people that were in leadership doing Butler are still employed by the Secret Service. I see them on different sites as well. And rank and file agents have been very critical of that. They don't have their head on a swivel. They have become reactive instead of proactive. And it's going to be under a lot of scrutiny this time. I don't think the American people are going to take this one and just let it be swept under the rug.
So I talked to Oz Perlman, and he was right by the president. He told me, and I want to just play the soundbite for you, what was going on leading up to the shooting, cut nine.
I was with the president and the first lady. I was kind of warming them up before my big show for everybody on TV. And the press secretary was there who's pregnant and expecting. And she actually asked me, can you guess the name of my daughter that I'm having next week? And this is the point where I kind of guess how many letters. If you watch the reveal, I write down the name. The first lady sees it. Weijia Jiang sees it from CBS News. The president sees it. Right when I turn it around, the timing is just insane because you see them reacting to my trick where they go, oh, but then we also hear the commotion out in the room where we're on the dais.
Here's more. Cut 10.
So we're a little bit elevated at the head table, and we see a ton of different SWAT, tactical, and Secret Service members running into the room, guns drawn, and noticing that right away, this is not the normal type of maybe a tray was dropped, or maybe somebody's having a medical condition, feeling faint of breath, falling, a heart attack, something of that sort that you see at events this large. This is something nefarious and dangerous, and you feel the hairs on your neck starting to lift.
So, yeah. And this guy's very attuned. He's literally a mentalist that actually might be, he's not trickery, in other words. Well, there's something going on with
it. And if you look at the photos and you see where Oz was and the president, and you see the CAT team, the counter-assault team, the guys with the long guns, get on the stage. I mean, that's jarring. And You know, I will say, Brian, you did stand tall in the middle of this all happening. And I stood tall for a second because I'm trying to, I actually went for my gun, but I wasn't armed because we were at this event, but it's just instinctually to go open up your jacket and go for it. And there was nothing there. And so then the Secret Service said, get down. I got down and I told Judge Jeanine, who was, and I said, you know, I said an expletive and I said, get down. Cause we didn't know what was happening at that point.
So I thought they were chasing a guy. Because I
that
said,
makes
well,
sense, though.
I said, wait a second, are they chasing? Because I'm smelling gunpowder.
Yeah.
And I said, who are they chasing?
Yeah.
But what were they doing? They were actually going for the VIPs.
Well, so what happens is when the president is there, remember, we had the cabinet members there. You had the House Speaker there. A lot of powerful people that normally.
Five of the ten most powerful.
Right. Normally travel with their own huge security detail. So what happens is when the president and the vice president, their team take precedent and you only get one of your guys that, or maybe sometimes two of your guys with you. So the moment that the shots are fired, all their other team is outside of the ballroom. So they come rushing in to find their cabinets and you hear them saying, I don't have eyes on them. I don't have eyes on them. They weren't talking about the shooter. They were talking about their cabinet member. So
they were talking to their earpiece, right?
And their earpieces. I don't have eyes. So eventually they start just jumping on the tables because it's get to them by any means necessary. And that's what happened. So a lot of people were confused because they thought, rightfully so, that either a protest or someone had got in to the ballroom.
Yeah, so, I mean, it was such a good time, too, right? We had the Fox party with so many interesting people.
Right. And the night was good.
And then you finally got a chance to meet Ambassador Waltz.
Yes.
You guys were talking.
Yes.
We were talking to Sean Duffy. But the thing is, they don't mind talking about business. Hey, what's going on? Hey, this is what I'm working on.
Right.
And see, that to me is my perfect night.
Right.
Because the small talk
you
which
love
drives
it.
You crazy.
Right.
But that's why these guys get into substance.
Right.
Because they know we care about what
right.
they're doing.
Right.
So at the same time, you meet. Casual setting.
Right.
You go, hey, what's going on over here?
Right.
What are you guys working on over there? And then all of a sudden, it makes you better the next day on your show.
Brian, I would describe it. It was like a family reunion because we know all these guys. Some of them are friends of ours, personal friends, before they got the big jobs. And, you know, with all of our busy schedules, we're all doing different things across the country. They're doing things across the country. You never get to see everyone at one location. So all of us come together. I actually thought it was a night of love, really. Everybody is talking, having a good time, having a few beers. You know, the night was great. It was crowded in there. You know, it was like sardines packed in there. It took me 25 minutes to get across. Once I got into the ballroom to get to my seat, it took me 25 minutes to do that because we were just packed on. And so everything is going well. And then you have this maniac who, you know, if you look at the manifesto, planned this for a while, got a key, got a room, and surpassed all the security measures. And they were not prepared.
So if I go into a hotel, remember the guy in Las Vegas?
Yeah.
How many guns he had?
That's right.
How many trips he made?
That's right.
There's no metal detector.
Right.
So we still have so many questions
well,
about
because,
that.
Because typically at a hotel, it's their venue. So normally when I'm in a hotel, I'm carrying, technically with my license, I could have carried into the hotel. But the moment you get to the perimeter of the ballroom, right, because it's still in the jurisdiction of the hotel. But the ballroom then becomes White House Correspondents' Dinner. That gives them the right to have Secret Service there to set up a perimeter for that. They should have gotten custody of the entire hotel because the barriers, it just wasn't far enough.
I saw, get this, in this hotel, if you haven't been to Washington or seen it, 1,147 rooms. And 47 meeting rooms. So you could say 47 other important things, whether
right.
it's a steel convention or an insurance
yes.
convention. So I have no idea who's there. I got a wedding. Okay,
right.
we're going to need one of those banquet rooms to get ready. And then
right.
we're going to go to the church. And we saw it as
right.
we got ready in vans to go to the vans and to go to the event. I'm watching a wedding.
Right.
You know, we're watching. Hey, we're going to a wedding in a minute. When I walked in, there was a woman, you know, obviously the bride, was sitting there. Now, has she been knowing? No one took that wedding party aside.
No.
But
even when we were going to our parties, right, because there's the pre-parties before, we were not wanned. There was no security at the point of us going to the party. And we're in the building.
We're in the building and about 50 feet from the ballroom.
Correct. It wasn't until, and by the way, there's reports out there that people that went into the ballroom that never went through security. How does that happen?
Right.
So
well, I'll tell you, I went diagonally and I was able to go to the secretary's room. So I got a chance to see RFK, Stephen A. Smith, who's arguably more important. Stephen A. Smith and our management was there, and Sean Duffy, and who was the, Scott Bessent. So I'm in there. And then when it, we're done.
Yeah.
Okay. We're done. So I walk, I took a picture with the bartender who's a fan. And everybody was gone by the time I was done. Yeah. So I walked out. I could have walked right into the ballroom.
Right.
But I decided, let me go to the, I'm going to go to the restroom now. So I had to walk diagonally back.
Right.
By the time I walked out, the magnetometer was set up.
Right.
And people going through it. And I go, okay, I don't have my ticket.
Yeah.
So I had misplaced my ticket or it was stolen from me. Someone else was sitting on my seat. That's another story. So when I got there, they said, Brian, yeah, someone else in your seat. It was a bit of a problem. So I don't know what happened with that. But I went back in, and then I had to go through the magnetometers again. But I was thinking to myself, I was feet from the ballroom. Where did this come from?
Right. Well, Brian, let's back up to your ticket situation. There was no identity with the ticket.
No.
No one. Now, let me give you a story about how lax this was compared to. They don't do that at football stadiums. One time, I went to the White House. The Secret Service greet me. We hug. We say hello. What's going on, guys? Appreciate you. When we get to the desk, it has my name on the list, right? Clearly, but my name is spelled wrong. The Secret Service agent knows who I am. We just talked and everything. Do you know they did not allow me into the complex because my name was spelled wrong? The vice president's office and president, I had to call over. They had to physically change my name, even though they knew it was me, but because it didn't match my ID, they would not let me into the complex until that was. That's how secure that facility is. This ballroom was nowhere near that.
Right.
Nowhere near that. Anybody could have had a ticket.
Right. And I think the president was all in. I thought the press conference was good. It was right on the money. I thought that the feeling there was more positive. He called on a CBS reporter to lead with. And they ask a human question.
Yes.
I treated him like a human being.
Yes.
Hey, how did you feel? This is it happened again. So I go, wow. You're actually acknowledging that he's a person.
That's right.
They never do. It's like, why would you do this? Why would you do that? Well, you're a terrible person. And they only get the president's retort because he is a guy that understands agenda questions. And I want you to hear.
I think it's shaking them.
Do you want to hear this?
Yeah.
This is on 60 Minutes. This set the president off with Norah O'Donnell. Cut three.
He appears to reference a motive in it. He writes this, quote, administration officials, they are targets. And he also wrote this, I am no longer willing to permit a pedophile, rapist, and traitor to coat my hands with his crimes. What's your reaction
to
that?
Well, I was waiting for you to read that because I knew you would, because you're horrible people, horrible people. Yeah, he did write that. I'm not a rapist. I didn't rape anybody.
You think he was referring to you?
Excuse me.
He's mad.
I'm not a pedophile. You read that crap from some sick person. I got associated with all stuff that has nothing to do with me. I was totally exonerated. Your friends on the other side of the plate are the ones that were involved with, let's say, Epstein or other things.
Mr. President,
and I was never, excuse me. Mm-hmm. You shouldn't be reading that on 60 Minutes. You're a disgrace. But go ahead. Let's finish the interview.
Well, he's rightfully pissed. I don't know if I can say that, but I'll say this. She elevated the shooter.
She did.
And it was a moment where I'm not saying that I don't know her thought process, but it appeared to agree with it and then say, ask the president, okay, what do you think about it? What is he supposed to say? What is he supposed to say? That did you think he was going to say, oh, yeah, this guy had a point? It was intentionally inflammatory. And by the way, it was the only quote that she read from the shooter. He said a lot of things in his manifesto. Why only just read that quote? And that was the president's point.
Right. He went on and on. They could have picked up any element of it, where he was appearing.
Yes.
He had a nickname. They were in the No Kings rally.
Yes.
They had a nickname for the group that was there. I don't want to go into detail. And then he talked about, there was a bunch of things, but they picked out the one thing that allows him to emphasize.
Right.
Emphasize why I think CNN and MSNBC and all these people have been all over the Epstein trial. They're trying to get Trump. And what they do is they're killing everybody in between.
Yes. What ticked me off, because she was there. She was at the event. I saw her. Was there no, thought process? And I was at this event. Maybe tone it down a little bit.
Right. Yeah.
Tone it down a little bit after you witness what took place. And that's why I said yesterday on Fox and Friends, give them until Monday. She surprised me. She went to Sunday.
Right.
So there you go.
And that show that had to pay a lot of money to President Trump, and it's going to help build the library.
So
maybe they can build the library again.
Right.
Lawrence, thanks so much. Been a busy few days.
Pleasure.
Thanks so much. All right, we're going to back in a moment. Bottom of the hour, Natan Levy. Don't move.
It's Brian Kilmeade.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. I don't know if you knew this, but anyone can get the same premium wireless for $15 a month plan that I've been enjoying. It's not just for celebrities. So do like I did and have one of your assistants switch you to Mint Mobile today. I'm told it's super easy to do at mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3-month plan equivalent to $15 per month required. Intro rate first 3 months only. Then full price plan options available. Taxes and fees extra. See full terms at mintmobile.com.
Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
So, yeah, we got a couple of minutes. One while Lawrence. Lawrence got a big law enforcement background, went through a series of academies. He trains police dogs as well as army dogs. So he actually goes to different military training. And I think he's got a sheriff's. He's been cleared to be a sheriff anywhere he wants to be, along with, obviously, his experience with guns. So coming, to get a perspective on what went wrong, what happened about this. This is the one thing that I have not got clarity on, and I was going to ask Kash Patel this, but I didn't have time. An eyewitness says that she watched the shooter get off 10 rounds. 10 rounds. Where are those holes? How did they miss? The only thing I heard he hit was the Secret Service agent right in the vest, which was aided by the fact that he had a phone under his vest, which helps block the shot. And then he was tackled. But I also, and you could see this too, see the Secret Service take a knee and shoot. Where did that shot go? Now think about it. You know how crowded that place was? I mean, if you have to be a fantastic shot under pressure in a crowd to take this guy out, and were they shooting? So I think that's another part of this. I don't know. The shots came out. I thought it was him. Other people said, no, they were shooting the guy. How did they get him? They tackled him. In the beginning, they said, we don't know if he's dead or alive. Well, he's alive. And then they had him. You see him just cuffed right there. Nobody's even really had their hands on him. So, I mean, it's a series of things that got to take place. But now, because I was talking to a high-ranking Homeland Security official last night, and they're already focused on the king. So the king and queen are coming here today. So they have to do incredible security. So they have to investigate what happened Saturday, make sure the president's secure today, and the king, who's not going to be with the president every minute. So they got to fan out and coordinate. And then they got to go back to the investigation Wednesday or Tuesday. So when the king goes to New York, where I am. All right, coming up next, Natan Levy, famous for his crusade against anti-Semitism and the belief that Jews should be fighting back against anti-Semitic behavior. He's going to be with us in studio. It's going to be great. He'll be with us in a matter of moments. And then we'll take your calls, 1-866-408-7669.
Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
This is an event that is actually the symbol of an open, free society. And to see journalists like you and others ducking under tables was just horrifying. We need a bipartisan national commission for political violence in this country. I heard Senator Tillis speak. We should look at social media. We should look at mental health issues. We should look at language. But we need to do something to bring the temperature down.
Well, put it this way. Ro Khanna going on with Hassan Piker. How about that? This guy says, kill Rick Scott. How about taking the first step to stop legitimizing him and going on there? And Gavin Newsom said he's going to do the same thing. And the Senate candidate from Michigan who wants to be the Democratic nominee against Mike Rogers. How about that? How about start not, you know, it's the same thing with people the extreme right. They just make a decision. Don't go over there. And if you need to vote for me, if I have to go on that podcast for you to vote for me, I'd rather lose. That's what should happen. So I don't even know. Listen, I think Republicans can be have inflammatory language, but I really think Democrats own the day when it comes to that. And you know who else agrees with me? Senator John Fetterman. Cut 45.
What I'm saying is that the Democratic Party is definitely changing. Well, when I was asked what's the leader in the party, I've said, yeah, that's easy. That's the TDS. You know, absolutely. You know, our beliefs are going the exact opposite of what Trump really supports for this things. And now, for example, like the Democrats love the New York Times, and now the New York Times love Hassan Piker, and Hassan Piker loves Hamas. I mean, you know, they just platform him all the time. And now they're celebrating, you know, shoplifting, and even here saying, well, maybe they have a point to gun innocent COOs down in cold blood. So that's kind of the parts of bizarre mutation and beliefs within my party.
Yeah, and Senator Fetterman, I guess his numbers are down with Democrats, but overall he's over 50% in Pennsylvania. I just hope he runs again. And I'll tell you what, if I'm a Republican, if I'm the Republican Party, I don't run anybody against him. I don't. It's just to underline the behavior where I'd rather deal with somebody at another party that will compromise, that will be logical. Still a liberal guy, but he's logical. To me, he reminds me of just a taller Bill Maher without the sense of humor. But listen to Jamie Raskin was actually challenged. Jamie Raskin, one of the impeachment lawyers, he's always calling out Trump and Republicans, never going along with anything. Cut 20.
And you have, as many of your fellow Democrats, have used some heated rhetoric against the president. And do you think twice about that when something like this happens?
Well, what rhetoric do you have in mind?
Just talking about some of the fact that he, you know, is terrible for this country and so on and so forth. I understand that that's your Democratic right. But overall,
yeah.
Do you
have
a responsibility?
I have no personal problem with Donald Trump at all. I mean, I talk about the policies of this administration, the authoritarianism like we saw on display in Minneapolis where two of our citizens were gunned down in the streets simply for exercising their First Amendment rights. Renee Good, Alex Preddy, and others have, you know, died in custody. I'm talking about policies. I don't personalize it. And I certainly have never called
him authoritarian. In that statement, he just called him an authoritarian. That's a dictator, an authoritarian, Hitler-like. So that's where it all works. He's not an authoritarian because ICE took out two protesters for various reasons. The guy had a gun, the miscommunication. Let's investigate. That doesn't mean that Donald Trump should be impeached, 25th Amendment, that ICE should not be funded, you idiots. Because no cooperation locally, the perfect storm happened in two separate incidents, and now you said that America is under siege. And people like Bruce Springsteen and others take that lead, and now they have a new mission. Robert De Niro, who gets all teary-eyed with anger every time he speaks. Hakeem Jeffries was asked about that. Cut 19.
Listen, I think that here in America, we can have strong disagreements, but it's important for us to agree to strongly disagree without being disagreeable with each other. And it is certainly the case that violence is never the answer, whether it's targeted at the right, the left, or the center.
So my hope is that when he makes some of these comments, Donald Trump, well, then Donald Trump could be tough too. I get it. But most of the time it's in retort and it's always counterpunching. I think 90% of the time is counterpunching. Very rarely do you hear him go after someone and think, where'd that come from? It always seems to be in response. Jonathan Turley wrote a book about this. You know, he's got a real sense of history legally, justice-wise, and also says, you know, what's going on here in terms of rage? And the name of this book is Age of Rage. So I thought he'd be perfect to book last night on One Nation, and he was. Cut 21.
We're living in an age of rage, and you have people who are fueling the rage. They're injecting rage directly into the body politic. They hope that that rage will carry them to victory in the midterms, bring them back into power. But, you know, rage is a very dangerous thing. It's addictive, and it's contagious, and people like it. And what can happen is that you lose control. And I think that's what you're seeing with some of these people who are feeding this rage addiction.
So what happens is, and I thought Reince Priebus put it great, is that they blame social media, the advent of it. There's been a lot of benefits, but he really believes that because there's a financial benefit to getting clicks, that has really changed things overall. Listen to what he said about coming together as opposed to ripping each other apart. Cut 22.
The problem here, Brian, is that, and you sort of hit it just there. I mean, in America, division is pure profit. Unity is a loser. There is no money in unity in America. There are no clicks in unity. There are no ratings in unity. Division sells. The algorithm rewards crazy. It doesn't matter about the fact. It rewards whatever can go viral. So political violence is content in America today. It is very, very troubling what's happening in the country.
So just, I mean, look, I'm not in the podcast world, thankfully. But if you are, you get up in the morning and if you say, well, I hope they have a bipartisan deal when it comes to Homeland Security, and maybe they can come together on immigration reform. And I hope we find a way forward in Iran, but they are a bad country. What have I told you? How I feel, number one. Number two is in the podcast world, in the world in which Joe Rogan doesn't live off that, so he's a bit of an anomaly. He really doesn't. But in that world where people look at political opinions, it doesn't go anywhere. I mean, sports world, too. I mean, when Stephen A. Smith comes out and he does his research and he says, okay, John Harbaugh will have the Giants in the Super Bowl, and here's why. That gets clicks. But if he says we have to wait for the season to play out and see what happens, it doesn't. So if I'm up every day and my money comes from my extreme rhetoric and my promises, predictions, my so-called sources that don't exist. Every day I got to go top myself. I don't have to top myself. I'm here to give you information, give you my opinions, weave it in with great guests. If my money was generated from extreme opinions, number one, I'd have to get a side job because I don't have extreme opinions. Some people might think they're extreme, but that's not my goal. My goal is to tell you what I think, and I'm not in a business where I need clicks, but they do. And guess what? They get followers. They get passionate followers. And some of them look at what's going on out there, not believing everything, embracing every conspiracy theory, and they are sprung into action. We got to change things. I will do change stuff. And the conspiracy theories aren't there already. And one of the conspiracies is that Donald Trump, with his ratings dropping, arranged for a would-be assassination attempt. That he was complicit. I mean, think about what would have to take place. And this is trending. He'd have to say, hey, who's a secret Earth Service agent? Doesn't mean being shot in the chest. Who's the one who wants to put their phone there to make it even more dramatic? Who's the one that wants to tackle the gunman with two knives, a shotgun, and another gun? Okay, good. Let's rehearse it for a month so it looks really real with all the press on the inside. And get this, they'll think their life's in danger. So people are believing that already, even though the president did the right thing in coming out and saying what we knew. And today we're going to find out more in the indictment. So when we come back, I will be able to take some of the calls. First stop, South Dakota. Then we'll go over to Texas and we'll try to get as many calls as possible. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. We are going to talk about Iran, too. Because those stakes are moving up, as well as the King's visit. I'm not really into the ceremonial visits, but I really believe that this visit is going to be so much more. You are listening to Brian Kilmeade Show.
Where big stories meet bigger conversations. Stay informed and energized with the Brian Kilmeade Show. Fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
We will try to build our Ukrainian and a system of anti-ballistic system. We need it. And, of course, we will share with all the partners without any questions. And because we need all of us, we need it. And not only to create the system, to create such capabilities which can produce more. Now, you know that the United States produces about 60, maybe 65 missiles per month, PAC-3 anti-ballistic missiles. It's nothing. During the first first day of attack on Middle East, you know, that they used the volume of 2 years production of such missiles during 24 hours. So we need our European independent strong system, and we will build it.
I understand that. I think he remains the best leader in the world, the most dire circumstances possible. And I know you might be fatigued from the war. Can you imagine what it's like fighting it, a war that was forced upon you? They have innovated themselves their own long-range missiles. They are aiming at the energy sites inside Russia while they continue to bombard with Iranian-made Shahed drones. Okay, they've found a way to go drone on drone. So you're going to hit me with a $20,000 drone? I'm going to knock it down with a $20,000 drone. No longer Patriot and THAAD missile batteries. And they're, you know where they have representatives today? In the UAE, Qatar, and Kuwait, building up their defenses against Iran. What do you say to that? You know, the Russians, they have more army people in the army, but pound for pound, the Ukrainians have the biggest and best army in Europe. All they're asking is, help me out to fend off an invasion of an enemy that wants to wipe you out too. But let's focus on what happened. Let's focus on what happened in Washington, D.C. with Jim in South Dakota. Hey, Jim.
Thank you for taking my call, Brian.
No problem.
Brian, I got a couple of comments and questions. First of all, it was stated on the news that that hallway was quite lengthy leading up to the ballroom.
Extremely wide, yeah.
Was there any security people stationed along that hallway, or was it just once that you made it past the last checkpoint that you had a free run? The second question I had I looked at the video of the moment the shooter entered the area where you had all of the officers stationed. Half of them were looking the wrong way. It looked like it was too relaxed for me. Okay.
Do you have a security background? It sounds like you do.
A little tiny bit. And the second thing, or last thing I got, is that all these guys are trying to pull out their 9mm out of their holsters and out from under their coats. And it occurred to me that, first of all, someplace along the way in that last area, I would have had Malinois, and I would have had semi-automatic riot guns. Overall length, 28 inches, easily concealable, but very effective. And you only have to point a shotgun. You don't have to aim it. Those are my comments.
Those are really good ones. Really good ones. And I can tell you, I didn't really, you know, I'm not looking for security. I was just looking for the bathroom. So, but they do look at the video, and I saw the video, and guys who had their backs against the wall looking straight ahead, not daydreaming, looking straight ahead at where people were walking through the magnetometers. So they're going to get through it. They're going to fix it. I don't think there's any doubt about it. I know the family's upset. The Trump family's upset. The president really isn't. But we do have to, the next time he has an event, he's going to ask, show me everything. Show me exactly what it takes to get in to be in the audience. You know, show me what it's going to take to get to me. How could someone breach this? So, like you said, I thought this was a great line in today's Wall Street Journal from a former FBI officer. He said, his name is Jason Pack. He said, they built a perimeter to stop an army. It turns out all they needed was somebody with their room key, because the day before he moved in, and with him, a rifle, a gun, and knives. But what they don't have is magnetometers out of Hilton. Either they don't have it on trains either. This guy got on a train in Los Angeles, went to Chicago, and then switched trains and went to D.C. with all that weaponry. Why didn't he fly? Because they wouldn't have allowed that. Ben, you're in Texas. Hey, Ben.
Ryan, can you imagine, to just dovetail what you're saying, if this had been a factor of 10, increased by a factor of 10, instead of just one person that caused all this chaos, there could easily have been 10 or even 15. I mean, as easily as they were able to get into that hotel, they could have gone in on staggered days, and then if you had a total, say, 15 or so that could have rushed inside, they would have overwhelmed the secret security so fast, and it would have been much more of a chaos. So, I mean, this whole thing, what Lawrence was talking about, I'm upset too. I mean, I just can't imagine the fact that the chaos that this one person caused Can you imagine if it had been 10 or 20?
Oh, yeah, if there was more than one. It was interesting because when I was interviewing O's last night, he said that we thought, though it was so loud, we thought it would be a bomb and that maybe there was a timer. There was a time when something else was going to blow. That's why he said, let me go down and cover up. And then they threw the president down, and he ended up eye to eye with the president of the United States on the ground on the dais. So it was pretty crazy. So he was just showing him a joke, and next thing you know, it happened. One thing about the president, and I mentioned this before, even before the incident on this weekend, when things get intense, that's when he gets his comments. Yeah, people get upset, and they go, why are you so mad at Rosie O'Donnell? Like, well, if someone says something, why do you go and attack them? Why are you worried about every fight? But when there are major, major challenges, whether it's you got to be cool, calm, to know what to do next with Iran, when you want to find out how to handle a crisis like the Access Hollywood tape, after Butler, calm, and now you have this situation where, by all accounts, not only was he calm, he wanted to continue. Chairman Mike McCaul, I talked to him for a while on Saturday. He's going to be going to Ukraine soon. He wants me to go with him, and I want to go too. See if I can work that out in July. Cut 15.
The thing that really takeaway I got was that the line of secession. You had the president and the vice president at the head table, both of them together, and the speaker of the House. Had an explosive device gone off, you would have knocked out the president, vice president, speaker. The three in line of succession.
So are you saying they shouldn't be in public together?
Well, I think the Secret Service needs to reconsider having both the president and vice president together, like at something like that. You know, Chuck Grassley would be the president had they all been taken out.
Because the speaker was there, Steve Scalise was there. He would have been next after the vice president. But Steve, you know, let's say the speaker was a casualty. Then Chuck Grassley, 92 years old. Wow. Incredible, right? 1-866-408-7669. Or write me at briankilmeade.com. This way I can see what you say, and I'll get to it as soon as I get a little bit of time in between guests. Who's in the Brian Kilmeade Show? So glad you're here. Don't move.
Hey, sweetie, your mother showed me this Carvana thing for selling the car. I'm going to give it a try. Wish me luck. Me again. I put in the license plate. It gave me an offer. Unbelievable. Okay, I accepted the offer. They're picking it up Tuesday from the driveway. I haven't even left my chair. It's done. The car is gone. I'm holding a check. Anyway, Carvana, give it a whirl. Love ya.
So good, you'll want to leave a voicemail about it. Sell your car today on
Carvana.
Pickup fees may apply.
News Radio Studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
From 48 to 6 in Midtown Manhattan, heard around the country, around the world, this is the Brian Kilmeade Show. We have a lot to discuss today. I want to get your views too, and you can write me if you feel more comfortable at briankilmeade.com about what you saw over the weekend. We have a lot going on. Today, by the way, Virginia Supreme Court will hear whether that whole referendum on redistricting is going to be constitutional. So though that vote that went the Democrats' way could be blown up, we got those dynamics too. This hour, I'm going to be joined by Stuart Varney, Stephen Moore, former chief of staff of the U.S. House of Representatives, founder of the Ukraine Freedom Project, and Michael Goodwin is standing by. Of all everything going on here, including the attack on billionaires, could have blown up in this communist mayor's face. So let's get to the big three.
Number three.
I predicted that something bad's going to happen and somebody's going to have blood on their hands. And I know the speaker is working with Senator Thune on a reconciliation package. I would hope this is a wake-up call to get it done as soon as possible.
Any more proof that Homeland Security needs to be funded and it's criminal? That it's not funded? That this Saturday night was the proof.
Number two.
If they want to talk, they can come to us or they can call us. But again, they know what has to be in the agreement. Very simple. They cannot have a nuclear weapon. Otherwise, there's no reason to meet.
Iran delegation in Moscow as evil meets evil when it's what it means for the end of this conflict. Why I believe time is on Trump's side.
Number one.
Law enforcement, you're right, executed multiple search warrants last night. What we have learned is that it appears he traveled from Los Angeles through Chicago to Washington, D.C., and it appears he traveled by train.
Yeah, why? No metal detectors. One of the reasons. That's just logic. No metal detectors from Los Angeles to Chicago, from Chicago to D.C. We'll talk about that. Todd Blanche, shooting at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, the Shooter's Creed, the security ring, and reality of more political violence. If this is going to change, it has to start in Washington. I'll explain. I just think that, number one, if someone disagrees with you, just say, I disagree with President Trump on the border. I disagree with his aggression when it comes to getting rid of illegal immigrants here. I disagree when it comes to cracking down on crime in D.C. and Memphis and Baton Rouge. I disagree with the big, beautiful bill. All right. Did I say dictator? Did I say authoritarian? Did I say it's the end of democracy? Did I say Hitler? No. President could wind it down, but for the most part, I don't think the president's been goes at you personally as a counterattack. The rest of the stuff is insane. What Democrats don't have is common sense. That's not an attack. That's just what I think. But they're not going to ruin the Western world. Eventually, philosophically, yes. Do they misunderstanding America? Yes. But do I think they're trying to kill me? No. Do I think that they should be hurt? Absolutely not. Michael Goodwin joins us now. I'm going to get to your theme of your column, which is great, about Trump and Netanyahu, how people are trying to divide the two, and it's just not going to work. But, Michael, I got to get your take on the White House Correspondents' Dinner and how it went down. What are the questions you have today?
Well, good morning, Brian. Look, I think the Secret Service handled the situation about as well as you could. Look, the setting and the security layers, they worked, but it's a pretty precarious situation when a gunman can get that close, not only to the president, but the vice president and the speaker are all there. So it's quite a moment when all of that is happening. And, of course, for the media to be there, it was an event that I think people will not soon forget. And the photos, I was not there, but the just seeing it unfold was really something to behold. But I think it does also speak to the climate of violence that has overtaken our culture, and that it should invade a space such as that is really not surprising when you think about what's going on in houses of worship and schools and everything else. So this is the violence in our society, as you were saying there, is really out of control, and it starts verbally. I think we all have to call on all politicians, everybody in public life, to tone it down, to keep it substance, but don't make it personal. And don't give the psychos any excuse. They don't need any ammunition. It's already in their warped minds. So I think everybody in public life has to tone it down.
What's amazing, too, so, and I said this on TV, but of course, if everyone's just listening for the first time, I was there. I was sitting right next to Erica Kirk, right next to Tulsi Gabbard. Two seats away was Erica Kirk, obviously traumatized already. She was already forced not to make an appearance at an event with J.D. Vance because of death threats on her. These lunatic podcasters here are saying horrible things about her after the death of her husband, Charlie Kirk. And now she shows up at this event, and next thing you know, we hear more shooting. She's a mother of a young child with just one parent, and you could imagine what's going through her mind. But having said all that, seeing these Secret Service agents come out of the woodwork running, I didn't know who was who. And you didn't know if there was a series of people running through, if someone was running wild. They never got into the perimeter, but they were tackled on the outside. I have questions. One of the questions is, there was an eyewitness who said the shooter squeezed off at least 10 shots. Thankfully, only one person was shot. If that's true, were they shot back at? I heard reports there was. We don't know the answer to that right now. And it looks like the shooter knew that they were going for Trump officials, wanted to avoid hitting any law enforcement, and wanted to get Trump. And also, Michael, a high college degree in engineering, right? This guy was coming up with video games, but he's living with his parents at 31 years old. And he also showing up at the No Kings rally. It seems like a radical leftist. But we're not the day of the the dead-end guy with 35 previous arrests that are let out and now become an assassin, take a back seat to what we see these young people who feel it's their duty to kill a political figure?
Yeah, and I think that, Brian, it's obvious to me anyway that those young people have come of age in an area, in an era where there are no sort of prohibitions of what you say. I mean, we've dragged free speech and turned it into a battleground. I mean, speech is one thing, but not everybody hears hears something the way the speaker intended. I don't believe most people in Congress or most people in public life are trying to stoke violence, but you can never know how some warped mind is hearing it. So you're not absolved just because you didn't intend it. You have to be more aware of the culture, the social media impact. All of these things, I think, are creating more of a culture of violence.
So in terms of the actual perimeter itself, the Secret Service is getting criticized because they should have been able to push it back, more magnetometers, QR codes on the invitations. It were literally like a wedding invitation from your neighbor. There was nothing else there. I personally never felt under threat, even in the room. I just wanted to find out what was going on, smelled the gunpowder, heard the shots. Here's Chris Swecker, former assistant FBI director, Cut 16.
I think the pre-planning has got to get better. They have to, when I say red team, they have to act like they're a bad guy and figure out how they can get into the venue and expand their imagination a little bit and understand how, you know, where their vulnerabilities are. And I think sometimes they get a little bit too rote and too complacent in setting up their security because they have magnetometer, great. But this guy exploited every vulnerability there was and almost successfully.
So that's an FBI director. So there's got to be better coordination, possibly. And plus, you just got a new head of Homeland Security who's unbelievably competent and courageous. But, I mean, you do have ramp-up time, correct?
Sure. And look, I think this is almost a unique situation where you have so many people in the nation's capital all converging on one event, all the different layers of security, the Metropolitan Police, of course, the FBI, the Secret Service, and even the parks people may have some role in this. So this is, I think, a very unusually complicated security situation. And in the end, it worked, but just barely. And I think that's the part that all of the agencies have to take from this, not a sense of satisfaction, but a sense of almost. And so we got another chance to do better.
So I want to talk about the theme of your column. It seems like everybody wants to break up Netanyahu and Trump and talked about divisions and different goals. And Netanyahu convinced Trump. No, Trump tells Netanyahu what to do. He's the junior part, Israel behind all the unrest in the Middle East. And you point out that that is not the case, and it's not going to be the case. They get along. There's mutual respect there between countries, and we have very similar goals.
Yes, you can't imagine a better partnership than Trump and Netanyahu for the mission of defanging Iran and for Israel, in addition, Hezbollah, which is not a minor thing. I mean, they have basically taken over Lebanon and turned northern Israel into a no-go zone. So Israelis living within the state of Israel are being driven from their homes by the constant threats and bombardment. So these problems have to be solved. But as I say in the column, Brent, the media in both countries, you know, diminishes Trump and makes him weak and vulgar. And of course, Netanyahu is weak and vulgar, according to much of the Israeli media. I mean, you have two politicians who have formed this incredible alliance, and they're treated at home as though they were somehow criminals. I mean, it's really striking when you think about, I mean, Iran was going to get a nuclear weapon to destroy Israel, destroy the United States, all of our Gulf Arab allies. That's what Iran wants to do. And for Trump and Netanyahu to band together, I'm sure they have both made mistakes. Not everything has gone according to plan, but that is the nature of warfare. And I think they have done a remarkable job so far, despite some mistakes, despite some unclear ideas. Nonetheless, this is a historic alliance between these two countries.
You think that they're going to end up fighting this out for another 10 days or here or there, a couple of weeks, to finish off the targets that we wanted to and let the Iranians know how much they're losing by?
It looks to me, Brian, as if this is going to drag on in this way where there's alternate bombing and attacks, and then there's a kind of ceasefire, and the Iranians string it along. I still see no sign that the Iranians really want a settlement that is acceptable to the United States. It's a little bit like Ukraine and Russia. Russia says it wants peace, but it will never give the very things that make peace acceptable to Ukraine. So it's kind of like that. The loser has the ability to keep it going almost endlessly.
Michael Goodwin, thanks so much. Appreciate it. By the way, I do think we're going to go back. Why? Because the foreign minister has basically said to the Egyptians, to the Tunisians, to the Pakistanis, we can't get on the same page with the others about what we want in an agreement with the U.S. I mean, it's going to be hard enough doing an agreement. But these guys think that by surviving, they're winning. They fully have to understand how much they lost. And maybe we got to do this again. We've used this time, I hope, to buck up the defenses of the Gulf states. That's my big worry. But we got to force that straight open and knock these guys out. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
In a world of noise, get the signal. Sharp, informative, and always on point. You're listening to Brian Kilmeade. Talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
You know, the way the mind works, right? There's subliminal messaging, which is not legal anymore. And then there's repetition, also known as suggestion. So we have this subconscious part of the mind. That's the hard drive. The conscious mind is sort of the gatekeeper. So through constant messaging over and over and again, racists, Hitler, this and that, over and over and over again, that bypasses the conscious critical mind of people, and it becomes a reality for them. Mm-hmm. And now you kind of couple that with all of the violent stuff that we're seeing through social media, and it's like you're creating this perfect storm. Mm-hmm. And then you get crazy people that are going to go get a gun and try to assassinate the president.
So that's Tom Kersting, a psychologist who does a lot of behavioral psychologists, who does a lot of work. He did a lot of work in high schools and the impact. One of the first to write about the impact of social media on psyche and how the greater communication could be really destructive and addicting. And Social Dilemma comes out in previous. Now we're in the age of AI. But a lot of people are seeing what's online, getting radicalized and thinking it's my job to take out Charlie Kirk. It is my job to try to kill Steve Scalise or as many Republicans as possible. It is my job to take out as many Trump officials as I can. I mean, this guy was referencing the fact that, you know, that's what he was going to be sad for the old life he left behind. But he thought he was going to be dying that day. And for me, sadly, he's not dead. Now we have to deal with him being in trial and other people thinking he did the right thing, which is just nuts to me. If you told me that 2 years ago, I'd go, no. A murderer is never going to be accepted in our society until Luigi Mangione. And when I see these girls show up and think he's doing a great thing, and I'm watching this Hassan Piker talk about the CEO needs to die because of all the other people, healthcare has fallen short for people. So this podcast with millions of followers says that, justifying it, justifying shoplifting. Things are getting twisted. And then you think X is your world. Instagram is the world. It is not the real world, thankfully. But that's one thing. You look at this guy, Ryan Ruth. Now, that guy was really out of his mind. The guy who shot, tried to shoot President Trump as he turned the corner on his golf course. The first guy somehow thought as though he should take things into his own hands. We don't have all the questions about him. Crooks. And then you have the Charlie Kirk shooter who seems so proud of himself in court. The guy's never spent a day in jail, detained, detention, dropped out of school, went in with all these accolades and scholarship. This guy's had a really easy life. And then decides from his online activism, he's got to take things into his own hands. Charlie Kirk. And we know the result. And then we have this other guy, again, highly educated, way to the left. All right, fine. So be an activist. You know, George Soros will finance those No Kings rally. Go ahead. That's what you choose to do with your life. But instead, according to his family, they get a letter the day before the attacks, and they're concerned he's going to do something horrific. And he tried. Rather not mention his name. But the whole world's watching. They said some nice things about President Trump to dodge another, literally dodges another bullet. It used to be a phrase. Now it's an actuality. When we come back, another big challenge around the globe, what's happening in Ukraine. Steve Moore is here. He's there every day working on the Ukraine Freedom Project. We, every American, should be pulling for Ukraine every single day. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show.
He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Could you listen?
We shared with the president of Azerbaijan that we are ready for trilateral talks. We have held such talks in Turkey, and we have held such talks with our American partners in Switzerland. We are certainly ready for the upcoming talks in Azerbaijan, provided Russia is ready for diplomacy.
So that is what's going on in that is President Zelensky through a translator talking about what they've done to innovate to not only stay alive, but begin to make real progress in Russia against Russia, a war they didn't want, but a war they're never going to quit. And I think Russians eventually will realize they're actually losing ground for the first time in 2 years. Let's listen to Steve Moore now. He's a former chief of staff in the U.S. House and founder of the Ukrainian Freedom Project, which raises money to aid the Ukrainians. Steve, what is the state of affairs right now in that war?
Yeah, well, you know, it's turning around, and I'll tell you why. The Russians have lost somewhere between 1.3 and 1.4 million soldiers, casualties and fatalities. And that's because they just feed soldiers into the, you know, just feed meat into the war machine, which they've been doing for 400 years. And the Ukrainians have innovated to such a degree that they're able to defend against the Russian drone strikes. And now their own drone strikes inside Russia have crippled Russia's ability to export oil. They have taken away the Russian ability to export about 400,000 barrels of oil a day. So Putin doesn't get the revenue. The army doesn't get the...
How much do they usually export?
Well, that's about 10%. No, actually, I'm sorry. That's about 40% of their daily exports. And so, and unfortunately, since we had to lift the restrictions on Russian exports, the sanctions on Russian exports, their revenue is going up. But the Ukrainians implemented their own sanctions, right? These missile-borne sanctions that have shut down a lot of
They've innovated export. Their own long-range missiles.
Yeah. Oh, yeah,
what
man.
What are they called?
The Flamingos. They have a rather flamboyant naming protocol there.
Do they go as far as the ATACMs?
Actually, these are more long range. These are more like cruise missiles. And so they're attacking deep inside Russia, like 1500 miles inside Russia.
Why are they gaining on the front lines?
Because the drone warfare that they've mastered is just killing the Russians. And so they have killed about 50,000 Russians per month. And now the Russians are only able to recruit about 35,000 people a month to go in there because it's a death trap, you know? And they've had to provide an extraordinary amount of money to people to go in. There's like a $50,000 signing bonus. And, you know, Russia's economy, the average monthly wage is about 20% of ours. So you look at a $50,000 signing bonus, and that's like $250,000 to you and me.
So here, I want you to hear Ed Luce from the Financial Times, Cut 49.
The Ukrainians have understood, you know, they haven't got a cent of new money from the United States since Donald Trump was re-inaugurated a year, 15 months ago, and they're not expecting any money. They still do depend on a lot of things from the United States, intelligence sharing, targeting information, until the Iran war, you know, Patriot defense batteries that have been paid for by the Biden administration. But essentially, they know it's done. Their future is Europe. And the fact that Orban was defeated a couple of weeks ago, Orban in Hungary, he had been blocking that $105 billion loan, which isn't really a loan, by the way, it's a grant. Ukraine would only repay it if Russia paid reparations to Ukraine for the war. So basically, they've got this hundred, because Orban's out the way, they've now got this money from Europe that's going to enable them to fight on and to keep innovating in this extraordinary way that David described.
They are the
world's most innovative.
Yeah, listen, Donald Trump's made it very clear that this is Europe's war. And it makes sense. And I'll tell you why. Because we're in a global war right now. Russia, China, Iran, North Korea, all the Islamic extremist movements and the folks, the cartels down in South America and Mexico, they're all working together against Europe and America. And so Europe needs to take care of its own war because America's got enough problems with China and what's right south of the border. So, you know, it's good that the EU has finally figured out how to do this. Now, the next step for Europe is stop buying Russian petroleum. France, on an average, well, let's all the NATO countries in Europe combined on an average day in February, bought enough petroleum from Russia to pay for 1,000 Shahed drones that Putin sends in to Ukraine to kill civilians. Mm-hmm. So, you know, last year they were a net negative between how much fossil fuels they bought from Russia versus how much money they sent to Ukraine for its defense. They sent more to Russia. So it's good now that they're trying to at least, you know, boost the Ukrainians. If they can cut off Russians, their money to Russia, that'd be
when
great.
How does this end? When does this end?
You know, it ends when Vladimir Putin has a reason to end it. And that's it. Vladimir Putin respects strength. And making accommodations to Putin doesn't work.
What is your take on the foreign minister of Iran showing up in Moscow an hour ago?
Yeah, I mean, listen, Russia's been sending weapons to Iran since December, maybe before that. And there's some of the guys that do open source intelligence research show that there was 18 cargo planes in the 90 days prior to the war that went from Russia to Tehran. And, you know, those were not filled with cookies, you know, they were filled with weapons that are being used against American service members.
So I think that the U.S. should be intercepting planes like that, just like they're intercepting boats.
Yeah, well, it's a mystery to me why that we're not taking better action against Russia. Russia is our enemy. Russia is now sending weapons to Iran to kill American service members. You know, that's not the right thing to do. That's not our friend. So, you know, in contrast, the Ukrainians who have, you know, there's 56,000 Shahed drones launched against Ukraine by Putin last year, and the Ukrainians took out 90% of them. So we, as I mentioned, we used $3-4 million Patriot missiles to take out a $35,000 Shahed in Iran. That math doesn't work for very long.
What about the electronic, the lasers, as well as the electronic shield that they put up to kind of bring them out of the sky?
Yeah.
Kind of jam them.
Yeah, well, the electronic warfare is the key. The problem is the electronic warfare changes all the time, and that's what the Ukrainians have learned.
Because they'll make an adjustment to whatever you do.
It's a chess game, you know. Okay, you move here, I'll move here, so you're constantly upping your game. And if you're not in that on a daily basis, then you're not learning.
Understood. So we'll see what happens, because Zelensky's made it clear he's there to help the Gulf states too. How important is that?
Oh, it's super important. You know, because you know, the Iranians have mastered this drone warfare using these cheap drones, and they're sending it into Dubai, they're sending it to Oman, they're sending it to Saudi Arabia. And if the Iranians are able to cripple the rest of the Gulf Straits oil supply, the the world economy slows down, and that's good for nobody except for Iran. And so, you know, I've got a friend, a guy named Brian Pickens, who I mentioned to you, who's he's a Green Beret. His last three deployments were in Ukraine before the war. So, and then he went back after he retired last year and fought for a year inside Ukraine. You know, he is fluent in Russian, trained to defeat the Russian military. He operated inside Russia during this time, and he came back and he just said, you know, we're not ready to fight a land war, because, you know, if the 82nd Airborne goes into Iran, they're going to get hit in the face with 1,000 FPV drones like the Russians do in Ukraine. And if you don't know how to defend against that, and we don't, then a lot of people will die.
I want you to hear this more from Financial Times editor Ed Luce, Cut 50.
Europe has, I think, digested what Zelensky has digested, which is they've got to plan as though America is not coming back. Europe has to build up its own sort of defense autonomy. It's really been a French line for decades, but now everybody sounds like Charles de Gaulle in Europe nowadays, including the British. And you've got people like Mark Carney of Canada asking if they can join. So this is a major, major shift. It's unfortunate that it's happening. It really is regretted, but it is reality. And Europe, I think, has finally woken up to this reality.
Your thoughts?
Oh, I don't find it regretful at all. You know, it's about time. You know, in 2014, they had a NATO summit that assigned a 2% of GDP goal, right? 2% of your economy should be spent on defense. And Europe collectively underfunded that for the last 12 years by $13 trillion. You know, and France, you said the French are leading. The French are not leading. Macron is a joke. And Macron,
he hasn't the firepower to lead.
Yeah.
So it doesn't matter what you do, what you say.
Well, and again, he's the guy that's sending enough money to Russia to pay for 200 drones a day to go against civilians in Ukraine.
Thanks so much for what you do, Steve Moore. The Ukrainian Freedom Project.
The Brian Kilmeade Show joins Fox Business's Varney & Company with Stuart Varney, live on your radio and on Fox Business. Here's Brian Kilmeade.
Well, thanks so much. We're going to be doing a simulcast shortly. Just got to remind you, you got to get our YouTube page. If you just go to youtube.com/@TheBrianKilmeadeShow, you'll see great clips. You'll see more from the radio show and other things I'm doing throughout the day. It's go ahead and subscribe and be part of it. We promise it's going to be worth your algorithm time. So we'll see that. Also, go to BrianKilmeade.com. Find out how to see me in Reno, Nevada, May 30th, streaming on Fox Nation. July 11th, I'll be in beautiful Pensacola, Florida. But for now, let's listen in with Stuart Varney.
Brian Kilmeade. All right, Brian, you're on. You were at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. Would you take us through it and tell us what you saw happen?
Well, number one, it was going to be an unbelievable event. I've been to 10 of them. I've never seen the room as packed as this. They say over 2,100 people there. Way too crowded, to be honest. You can't even walk through between tables. But it didn't take long after you have your salad, a few announcements, and next thing you know, you see a loud noise, and you see a bunch of guys running as fast as they can into the auditorium, at which time I didn't know if they were chasing somebody, but you all of a sudden saw not really, I can't say chaos, because almost everybody there, nobody was panicking. It was just seeing RFK and Tulsi Gabbard and Mark Wayne Mullen and the Speaker of the House and Pete Hegseth all being brought out in different directions. And you turn around and look at the dais, and it is totally cleared out. So you knew something was going on, and next thing you know, they were clearing it out, trying to get to the bottom of it, and there was rumors about a shooter, and sure enough, it smelled like shots, and it was shots. And we're still trying to figure out what happened at the exact interaction, because we hear an eyewitness this morning say that she heard at least 10 shots from the shooter. All right, thankfully only hit once. And then were there shots from the Secret Service? I think the answer to that is yes, and we're about to find out too. And then you had to clear out 22,000 people in a very short period of time. And I was able to get out of there pretty quickly in a very rainy night, and then try to put this whole thing together. And now we're in the process of analyzing what could be done better. In terms of the actual event, Stuart, I don't think the agents could have acted more courageous and more organized in terms of who set up the perimeter. What were the protocols to get through? How do you handle over 1,000 rooms and over 49 different celebration rooms, auditorium rooms, meeting rooms? I don't know if the answer to that is.
It's a ballroom. That's what we need. But look, the president wants the dinner rescheduled and soon. Listen to this.
Well, I know the White House Correspondents Association very much appreciates you going last night and honoring a commitment to do it
again. I hope we're going to do it again. Nora, tell him to get it going, and we should do it within 30 days, and they'll have even more security, and they'll have bigger perimeter security. It'll be fine. But tell him to do it again. We can't let something be. It's not that I want to go. I'm very busy. I don't need that. I think it's very important that they do it again.
Two questions, Brian. Do you think there should be a redo? And what do you make of them reading the manifesto to the president?
The excerpt that they read, that Nora O'Donnell read, was designed to insult him. There were so many different things of interest in those documents, in that screed of interest. You know, where this guy, what he believed and what his targets were. But to go ahead and read that excerpt, that was just like a backhanded slap, because that's one twisted guy's opinion of the president. Why read that? And the president blew up, kept his tone down, but the words were direct and they were curt. And they're saying, what are you doing? That's what you get from 60 Minutes. I mean, time and time again, you saw Leslie Stahl do it a couple of times. Then the last time they did, the president sued and won. He's building up a nice library because of that. And then you have it again, an interview of interaction, recounting an event from the president's point of view. And then you bring up that excerpt. I think the president had every right to blow up at it.
Okay. Brian, unfortunately, we're out of time, but we always thank you for being with us.
No problem. All right, so that was going on the President of the United States yesterday, but we are looking at different things with this character has said and what people have said about him. Now, I'm very curious to see if drugs are involved. Not so much drugs to like recreational drugs, but mind-altering drugs. Because immediately they say he was cooperating, saying about his intention, he had his writings, and then it shut down. I'm wondering if he realized either a lawyer got to him or he started sobering up. And just to be example, I love the way these guys acted, how quick they acted, how organized they were. But I'm looking at a quote from the Wall Street Journal today from Jason Park, former FBI officer. He said the Secret Service built a perimeter to stop an army. However, they were beaten by a room key. What does that mean? Well, the guy got on reportedly with his guns and his knives in Los Angeles, and then took a train to Chicago. From Chicago, he went to Washington, where he checked in one day early. And when he got that day early, he then suddenly had access to the building. And once in access in the building, he was able to case it out and scan it out. And his plan was, go through the magnetometer as fast as you can, pull out the gun, and shoot as many people as possible. They got through. An eyewitness saw him put his gun together, his rifle together. He writes in the screed, I made it a buckshot. Okay. And then he ran through and he was tackled, but not before shooting an officer in the chest. And a phone reportedly was able to stop the bullet and played a role in stopping the bullet. I've never set up a perimeter on an event for the president. I'm not going to pretend to be an expert. But you do have to evaluate all the time that there are breaches. And you got to figure out what you did wrong. And I think that that's where they're heading now. I also think you should work out the commonality between some of the recent shooters. What is Crooks from Butler? What is the shooter from Charlie Kirk over in Utah? What role did he have? How is it similar to this shooter? All 20-somethings, 30-somethings, all highly educated, all believe it's their duty to take out the president, to take out significant leaders, to say that some people shouldn't live. Not uneducated people, but twisted.
News headquarters in New York City. Always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. So glad you're there. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show coming your way. Back in action today after a trip to Washington and all the drama that took place there. And back from Houston, where we were doing the show for a special for 250 for Fox and Friends. Was able to be able to stay in Houston and do the radio show and get a sense of what Texas is like. Always great. Chris Recker is going to be joining us at the bottom of the hour, former FDI assistant director. Dennis Ross is standing by for the latest on Iran as the foreign minister goes to Russia. That's more than symbolism. Let's get to the big three.
Number three.
I predicted that something bad's going to happen and somebody's going to have blood on their hands. And I know the speaker is working with Senator Thune on a reconciliation package. I would hope this is a wake-up call to get it done as soon as possible.
I would think so. Funding Homeland Security should be automatic, but I thought so 6 months ago. Mike McCall, any more proof Homeland Security needs to be funded? What about the events this weekend? It is criminal that they're not.
Number two.
If they want to talk, they can come to us or they can call us. But again, they know what has to be in the agreement. Very simple. They cannot have a nuclear weapon. Otherwise, there's no reason to meet.
That is President Trump talking about the Iran delegation in Moscow as evil meets evil when it means what it means for the end of this conflict. Why I believe time is on Trump's side.
Number one.
Law enforcement, you're right, executed multiple search warrants last night. What we have learned is that it appears he traveled from Los Angeles through Chicago to Washington, D.C., and it appears he traveled by train.
Wow. Why? To avoid the metal detectors, perhaps, so he could bring his weapons. Shooting at the WHCD, the shooter's creed, the security ring, and the reality of more political violence. If this is going to change, it starts in Washington, D.C. I'll explain. For temporarily, anyway, the front page of the news is not about Iran. But it really should be, and it will be. Dennis Ross knows that. He's a fellow at the Washington Institute for the Near East Policy, author of Stagecraft, and a William Davidson Distinguished Fellow. Ambassador, welcome back.
Brian, always good to be with you.
As you know, we're looking at a visit from the foreign minister to Russia. Why is he going to Russia?
He's there to see how he can ensure that the Russians will continue to support them. One of the interesting things about the Iranians, they hate to be politically isolated. It's actually one of the points of leverage that we can build on them is to try to keep them isolated. So he looks to the Russians, both to avoid political isolation, but also for material assistance. Look, they provide drones to the Russians. The Russians are providing intelligence to them and obviously offering advice as well and probably suggestions about how they should be approaching President Trump. I think it's a symbiotic relationship between the two. As I was listening to you say, these are both, I think, really malicious kinds of actors, malign actors.
So here's the President of the United States talking about what's next. Cut 32.
If they want to talk, they can come to us or they can call us. You know, there is a telephone. We have nice secure lines, although I'm not sure any telephone line is secure, frankly. But we have secure lines, and if they want, we can talk. But we're not sending people to travel 18 hours to meet where you literally, think of this, we had a meeting for Tuesday, and it was on Saturday that I was saying, when are we meeting? Tuesday. Mm-hmm. But we're going to do it by telephone. So if they want, they can call us. But again, they know what has to be in the agreement. Very simple. They cannot have a nuclear weapon. Otherwise, there's no reason to meet.
And he also said with the blockade and turning down all these ships, including Chinese ships, they really only have a few days left of storage of their oil. Soon they're going to have to start capping wells, which means in that respect, time is not on Iran's side. What do you think?
I think the issue always is how do they see it? And I think they believe time is on their side because with the blockade, the effect on the global economy, the concern about oil prices, which obviously the president demonstrated early on by allowing them to sell their oil when no one else could for about 3.5 weeks, they saw that as a point of leverage. So whether they should see it that way or they don't, they have seen it that way. My answer to it would be, how do we change their calculus further? And what I'm about to suggest has a risk to it.
Go ahead.
The blockade absolutely should be kept on. But I would say, okay, it's time for us to open the straits so that everybody else can use it, even while they can't. Now, again, they will try to lash out. But the minute it becomes clear that others are going to be able to export and they can't, then the price they're paying becomes much higher in their eyes, because what it also demonstrates is once others can export, it means we will be able to control much more the price of oil, and therefore it becomes much more sustainable to us. We have to change this view that they have, that right now time serves them. You may be right in an objective sense. The problem always in this kind of a reality is you're dealing with a subjective nature and what are their perceptions. Right now, their perception is time is on their side, and we have to change that.
So you're saying that we should go in there with our destroyers and our ships and open it up and then provide an escort for the other ships? Yeah, do you have mine clearances as well?
Well, the way you do this is first you create a channel. It's not when people say, you know, there was a report out last week about the Pentagon saying it would take 6 months to clear the Straits of Mines. It doesn't take 6 months if what you're doing is you're opening a narrow channel to begin with. But we have a lot of underwater drones that can check to see if there's any moored mines. We have all sorts of surveillance techniques right now to determine whether they're laying more. We can clear a channel. It may be narrow, so you're not going back to 140 ships a day, which is the way it was on February 27th, but it can be much more than it is now. Now, yes, you have to escort. You have to do what we were doing for a while in the Red Sea. You have to be able to counter their anti-ship cruise missiles. You have to be able to counter drones. You have to be able to identify all the small boats which can drop mines. But we have the surveillance capabilities out there to do it, but it does run a risk. I'm not minimizing that. They may decide, well, look, we're going to have to hit the Gulf partners, our Gulf partners, harder. But then again, the question is, how much capability do they have left? How long can they do that? Again, I come back to you're trying to affect their calculus. It was good, by the way, that the president said, look, they can call us. That's the message that says, okay, you think I'm afraid of time? I'm not afraid of time. But it has to be, it can't just be words. It has to be actions that also demonstrate, okay, we're ready to live with this. You're really, if you look at it, you have to ask yourself a question. Are you really ready to live with it? Right now, they are.
So Axios has this report, one source saying the foreign minister, Arachi, made it clear to the Pakistanis, the Egyptians, Turks, and Qatari mediators over the weekend that there's no consensus inside the Iranian leadership about how to address the U.S. demands. The U.S. wants Iran to suspend uranium enrichment for at least a decade and remove its enrichment uranium from the country. We got to go way past 10 years. So there's no consensus inside Iran about how to answer. And when I brought that up to an ambassador who used to ambassador to the region, they said, well, that's convenient, that maybe they're overstating that for their own needs. What's reality?
It's a combination. I actually mentioned this to you before, that during the negotiations over the JCPOA would always talk about how he was constrained by the hardliners. That can be true, but it's also convenient. Right now, I think probably the one person that probably should not have been killed was Larijani, because Larijani was the one guy who could influence all the different factions. You really don't have anybody like that quite now. So when I come back to affecting the calculus, I'm talking about the key Revolutionary Guard leaders. So it's Vahidi. Now, he's also influenced by Rezaei. Rezaei was the first head of the Revolutionary Guard. By the way, when Khomeini acted to end the Iran-Iraq war, he was the one arguing not to end the Iran-Iraq war. So he's one of those with Vahidi who you can assume is convinced that time is on their side. By the way, the two of them, are their red notices on them because they were behind the bombing of the Jewish Community Center in Buenos Aires in 1994.
So I want you to hear what Hillary Clinton said. Cut 34.
Before Trump blundered into this war, the Strait of Hormuz was open. A quarter of the world's oil supply flowed through it. Now it's closed. Every other president knew this was a risk. It was part of every war game that I was ever part of. Yet Donald Trump was caught by surprise. He couldn't believe that they would close the Strait of Hormuz. He walked right into the trap. And he gave Iran a powerful new strategic advantage. Because of Trump, They now know they can close the strait whenever they want and bring the global economy to its knees.
So what's your thought?
He might as well.
Yeah, what's your thought on her? I mean, everything she does, Donald Trump does, is wrong. Is this an example? Is she right?
In this particular case, I'm afraid she is. Because I'll tell you, every tabletop exercise I took part in, one of the first things that we looked at in every case, if it was going to be a conflict, was what we're going to do about the straits, without exception. So I am afraid that, you know, in this particular case, that was not a high priority, and it should have been.
But reopen, do you think it's a trap for us to go in there? You think they wanted us to bomb them?
No. They didn't want that. But the reason in the past, why did they never close it before? The reason they never closed it before is because they knew it would produce the very war. But once they were in this kind of a war that they saw as being a threat to their survival, as they define it, then they had very little to lose. But they hadn't done it before, and we had anticipated that if there was going to be a war, this is what we'd have to deal with. They were afraid of doing it because they were afraid of the consequences, but they were already facing those consequences. So from that standpoint, that price, as they saw it, disappeared.
So, having said that, I was talking to military leaders. They said, we've been working on this since the 80s. There's no scenario where we didn't have a plan if they were going to try to close the strait. So one of those plans, I guess, is the blockade, and the other would be physically clearing it ourselves, right?
Correct. And that's why I'm saying to you, Brian, that the blockade, you know it, we've had several conversations. I was in favor from the blockade from day one. So because I was looking, what's our counterpoint to them? Well, one way is to stop them from being able to get anything, and that chokes off their revenue. But the problem with the blockade is it also affects us because it's also affecting the global economy. It's also affecting the price of oil. And the longer it goes on, it's not just the price of oil. It's also fertilizer. It's also helium, which is used in semiconductors. So we pay a price, too. So that's why I'm saying the longer this goes on, there's at some point, if you want to affect the people like Vahidi and Rezaei and Zolgar, the three who I think are probably the key decision makers right now, they need to see that, yeah, they're losing, and we have a way so that we're not losing. That's the only way I know to change their calculus, unless you want to wait the next 3 months. And I'm not, that's going to be a pretty high price to the global economy and to ours as well.
What would be the result if you blew up Karg Island?
You blow up Karg Island, it's going to affect the Chinese probably more than us. One of the problems with some of the attacks that we would carry out is, the Iranian public, at least in part, we're doing some of this. They will view that not as the regime's assets, but the country's assets. So they will view it as something that's designed to hurt them, not just the regime. We should also be thinking strategically about where we want Iran to be. As I still believe, the worst thing, by the way, for this Iranian government, the guys I was talking about, the worst thing is for this war to end. Because then they're going to have to contend with all the fundamental contradictions of this regime, and they don't have the means and the wherewithal to deal with it, partly because of the nature of their corruption, partly because even if they get some kind of real economic relief as part of a deal, they'll still have to make really hard choices in terms of what they choose to put money into, given the scale of what their needs are. I still believe there's, in 12 to 18 months, there's a high potential for an Iranian Gorbachev to emerge. By the way, you know, you mentioned my book, Statecraft 2.0. I have a long chapter in there on Iran, and I read every Khamenei speech from the 1990s up until 2024. And one of the things that came through repeatedly was not only how he looked at us, but his fear of Gorbachev, a fear that Iran would produce a Gorbachev. It was constantly mentioned by him. And the reason for that is because you have someone who comes along and says, we can't save the Islamic Republic unless we change who we are, meaning we have to focus on domestic development. We have to end our isolation with the rest of the world. We have to stop our confrontation with our neighbors. That's the only way we will save who we are. I still think the sooner the war ends, you may have a year where we'll be uncomfortable, but I still think the potential for an Iranian Gorbachev to emerge is there.
I know.
Clearly, the Supreme Leader was afraid of it.
We've got to find a way to get that Evian prison open. I know they hit the door in 2025. I wonder if they could do something else.
You're right, 100%.
All right. Always great to talk to you. Dennis Ross, this is an exciting time for and the most hopeful time ever, as dire as some challenging as it is, for Iran to be amongst the family of nations. Thanks so much, Dennis. Back in a moment.
From breaking news to big name guests, Brian brings you insight you won't hear anywhere else. You're listening to The Brian Kilmeade Show. Information you want. Truth you demand. This is The Brian Kilmeade Show.
Look how far you've come. 30 years ago, you were just some rich guy on Jeffrey Epstein's private jet out of Teterboro, but you worked hard, you stayed friends, you shared some wonderful secrets, and because of that, you were able to fly on that plane seven more times. Dreams really do come true. Am I right, Dog the Bounty Hunter? That's right. We miss you so much. And of course, our First Lady Melania is here. Look at Melania, so beautiful. Mrs. Trump, you have a glow like an expectant widow.
So those are the type of comments that have gotten under the skin of Melania Trump. And because they're not funny, they're attacks, they're hateful. And a lot of times she would look the other way. She's not doing that now. And she came out with a statement on X. In fact, I'll look it up right now because she wants this to make news. She says, essentially, this guy needs to be taken out. Here we go.
Here, Brian, she said...
where is that? Okay, go ahead.
There you go. Melania, she called for ABC to take a stand against Jimmy Kimmel over his hateful and violent rhetoric, was essentially the gist of it. Because by calling her an expectant widow and joking about her marriage days before, you know, there was the assassination attempt.
Well, you know, it's a, see, he said, okay, he doesn't want to have a typical roast. He doesn't want to have a comedian. So I'll tell you what it would have been like if they booked her, if they booked him. So he went and did his monologue, at which time he brings up the opportunity to maybe shoot or kill the president. So Melania came out, called for ABC to take a stand against him. Remember, they suspended him once before, got backlash. He looked like a hero, and they brought him back. His ratings went up, but now they're back down. He said, people like Kimmel shouldn't have the opportunity to enter our homes every and spread her hate. He's a coward. Kimmel hides behind ABC because he knows the network will keep running cover to protect him. Enough is enough. It is a time for ABC to take a stand. I don't know. It just makes these guys martyrs. Colbert's going to be leaving soon. I think he probably leaves under his own volition when it's not cost-effective to have him. I think the president going after him is not fruitful. But the First Lady might be a little different. I just think also he didn't learn anything from mocking Charlie Kirk.
From his mouth to your ears, it's Brian Kilmeade.
The manifesto, yeah, manifesto, can you believe it? And so he's got some big problems with the rest of his life. But it's very, very bad, very bad situation. But his family knew that he had difficulty. And his family seemed to be, I think they spent a lot of time with his family. His family said, he had big difficulty. Maybe they should have reported him a little bit more strongly, probably. But it's a hard thing to do, I guess.
They're talking about what they know about the shooter, what he wrote to his family the day before. He tried to kill the president and as many aides as possible. He did shoot a Secret Service agent who, thankfully, is 100% ready to go. So we'll see where we go from here about the investigation and what they might have done wrong. Chris Swecker joins us now. He was kind enough to join me last night on One Nation Live, former FBI assistant director. Chris, what are we learning now? We like the way seemingly the agents acted in the time of crisis, but leading up to it, have you seen some holes?
Yeah, I mean, I look at it with a critical eye. First, you got to give them credit, the agents on the ground credit for taking action the way they did. And they prevented a mass casualty event. They probably would have never gotten to the president, but they could. He could have inflicted great damage And so they were acted quickly, decisively, and they stopped him. But, you know, as a security professional, you have to look back and say, okay, did they red team themselves? You know, as we discussed last night, did they creatively look at their own security scheme and look for vulnerabilities, if you will? And there were vulnerabilities. I mean, somebody was able to stay at the hotel, come down the back stairs and unchallenged. So you could have unlimited, if you're staying there or you're participating in another event at the hotel, which is massive, then you have free reign until you get right to the venue itself. And then he tried the only way to get by, the only way you could get by, which was rush by. But he was able to assemble a shotgun and in the hallway or in the stairwell and burst out of there with the shotgun at the ready. So, you know, you would think with a finite number of exits or entrances that you could cover all of those, and you would cover all of those.
So we understand an eyewitness said they watched him put it together by the bar carts that were abandoned by himself, and he stood up and just ran as quick as he can right through. And the magnetometers were just sitting there. I guess they were being disassembled little by little. But now we understand, according to our eyewitness, he shot 10 times, only hit once. Do you know if any of our guys shot?
You know, I have not heard any reports that Secret Service fired their weapons, and they may have not fired their weapons because, you know, there's very thin walls in that hotel, and they don't know where those rounds will ultimately end up. I mean, they have handguns that are designed for impact and to impact the body and stop there, but they can't be guaranteed, you know, that they're not going to miss. They don't know what was behind him, whether there are other agents down the hall as well. So if they didn't fire, they didn't fire for good reason, I would say.
So a couple of things. He called himself in his screed the friendly federal assassin, even though essentially he has no criminal record. He went to those No Kings rally. He also had a nickname for his group amongst them. He claimed the attack was his moral duty. Doesn't that sound similar to the Charlie Kirk alleged assassin?
Yes. And, you know, somebody pointed out that the protesters had signs outside saying death to tyrants. And we've seen those signs all over the place at these protest rallies, so-called rallies. And, you know, I think it reflects that what they're being told by their so-called political leaders, that violence is okay. You got a just cause here. Donald Trump's responsible for all your problems. Go after him aggressively. And anyone else who's conservative, for that matter, any iconic, high-profile conservative or Republican. We don't see, again, I don't want to get too political here, Brian, but you don't see this happening with so-called progressive politicians. It's just not happening.
So, I mean, if I, for example, heard that bin Laden, after 9/11, was coming back, he's going to come to the United States, and we know what he's intended, we know he's already done. I've never killed anybody before, but I would know that bin Laden is an enemy of the people who kill thousands unless I do something. That seems to be what crooks and others and what the other assassins are trying to do along the way here. Three times to the president, and then, of course, to Charlie Kirk.
Right. I mean, and they're all accompanied by some version of a manifesto, if you will, that kind of lays out what they're up to and why they're doing it. And, it, you know, these are, as Donald Trump described it, they're crazy, but they're not stupid. They're the kind of people that have high enough intelligence to plan and able to sort of exploit security vulnerabilities. Some of them have traveled across the country, in this case with weapons, on a train, went on a train because he knew they weren't secure. Checked into the hotel, he had the presence of mind and intelligence to come up with that plan, saying maybe they don't have as good a security if you're staying in the hotel. And he turned out to be right and even commented on it in his manifesto. So, you know, this is not an isolated instance. These are a series of incidents like this over time. So there's a common thread through all of it. And it's that sort of that poisonous message that has gone out, that toxic, malignant message that will reach people like him and spur them to action. And politicians do that knowing full well that they're out there.
So when you find out that J.D. Vance, the vice president, was out of the building while the president was still on the dais, some people say it was a strategy. Get the president low until you find out where the danger is. Other people say his detail was second to the number two. What do you think?
No, I think it was a matter of proximity, number one. And number two, the president's already said he didn't want to leave. He fought the Secret Service agents just like he did at Butler. He wanted to see what was going on. I think he was looking for an opportunity to make a stand like he did last time and make a statement. So I think that he's a harder case to move quickly out of a scenario like that. He's bigger, bulkier, wasn't as close. And I think they all went to their respective protectees and did what they were supposed to do.
So if you're today, they're focusing on the king. And they while it's trying to analyze what went wrong at the Hilton. So you need a lot of resources. Chris, it's got to stop with us not fully financing Homeland Security, don't you think? I mean, this is a crisis moment.
Absolutely. I mean, people don't realize what a resource and expenditure this is to not only cover that event, but also now investigate it by the FBI, because the FBI is the lead agency in a situation like this. So they're going to fan out all over the country. Anywhere he's been, they're going to, and anyone who's talked to or texted with, they're going to go visit them personally. They're not going to call them on the phone and say, what do you know about this guy? So you're going to have teams of two. You got subpoenas and ex parte orders going out all over the social media sphere, if you will, to get all of that stored data, the iCloud, whatever it is, whatever stored, anything that comes from an internet carrier takes a little bit of time, and it takes time to get to a magistrate or a judge and get them to sign it. So, you know, there's a lot going on behind the scenes, and then you have to forensically exploit all of that, his devices, et cetera.
And the fact is, he was cooperating initially, and now he's not. Right. Is that unusual?
I think it's not unusual for them to cooperate initially. In fact, many cooperate all the way through the process until they get to an attorney. And that's just because they do want their message out there. They do want people to know why they did what they did. They want the notoriety. And it's only when, you know, in some cases, until they get in front of a judge and are told that they have the right to have an attorney, and the judges will almost force an attorney on them in that that first hearing, initial appearance. So, you know, they like to talk. They like to write. They like to post. When I say generically they, I mean people like this that we have seen in this series of events over the last couple of years.
Yeah, I guess we're going to find out what's going to happen. What's the role of the FBI in something like that, in an event like this?
In the event itself?
Yep.
Well, they're secondary to the Secret Service in the security for the event. But they are part of the, you know, part of the event itself, because they are required to investigate any breach of security or any assault like this, any attempted assassination, anything that even remotely looks like an attempted assassination. The FBI has primary jurisdiction because the Secret Service is not going to investigate itself and their own security schemes. It's just, you know, they wanted a third party objective agency to come in and do
that. And they're going to do that? The FBI will do the investigation?
They will, yes. I mean, the Secret Service will do their own internal, but the real official FBI investigation and the one that will support the prosecution will come from the FBI.
So we know that there were 1,147 rooms at the Hilton, 47 meeting rooms. Five of the top 10 most powerful people in the world attended. It were a part of the 2,200 there. But there were so many people there for different reasons, obviously. You have an option. I guess the Israelis clear out the whole hotel when Netanyahu comes into town. We're not going to do that. That's not really what we do. Do you have to just maybe no longer do events when hotels can't shut everything down for you?
Honestly, I think we're in that environment. If you want, we are going to continue to see this type of thing, because I think there are a lot of others out there that are just waiting to get activated, waiting to call to action. And then any public event, when it's announced and it's known ahead of time where and when the president's going to be at a certain place, then the whole world knows where he's going. And, you know, ordinary security just ain't going to get it anymore. It's got to be extraordinary security. I keep saying red team. I was the head of security at the largest financial institution in the country after I retired. I hired a team of security people to do nothing but go around the country and try to penetrate our buildings. And that does two things. It gets them on their toes, number one. Number two, you identify your vulnerabilities.
Wow, that's interesting. Chris, you know what I worry about personally? When he's done, he's always going to be a target the rest of his life. He's right. Never going to have the security, and still they're able to get to him. I mean, when he's done at Mar-a-Lago and doing events and speeches and showing up at his library, there's always going to be a sense of peril.
Absolutely. I mean, you got the Iranians after him. You got, you know, the Venezuelans, the Cubans, the Cuban government. I mean, he's got some enemies out there, and they're very determined, and they play the long game. So, you know, it isn't just these wing nuts out on the, you know, out there in their incubating in their parents' basements. It's the, you know, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard. It's all kinds of state sponsored actors out there that are going after him. You know, he's I have to give him this. He's fearless. He's not going to back down. He's out there.
He is. Chris Wecker, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Yeah, Brian, thank you for having me on.
You got it. 1-866-408-7669. Okay, I'll squeeze in some calls also. I'm going to play you O's, you know, the mentalist. He was with the president, showing the president, demonstrating how good he was right before the event started, maybe loosening him up to get him involved in the show a little bit because the president was going to give a speech. What he saw after I interviewed him last night on One Nation. Don't move.
Keeping you informed, engaged, and always a step ahead. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show. A talk show that's real. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show. Sponsored by Prevagen. Prevagen, made for your brain.
I was with the president and the first lady. I was kind of warming them up before my big show for everybody on TV. And the press secretary was there who's pregnant and expecting. And she actually asked me, can you guess the name of my daughter that I'm having next week? And this is the point where I kind of guess how many letters. If you watch the reveal, I write down the name. The first lady sees it. Weijia Jiang sees it from CBS News. The president sees it. Right when I turn it around, the timing is just insane because you see them reacting to my trick where they go, oh, but then we also hear the commotion out in the room where we're on the dais.
Right. So let's continue. This is Oz Perlman on One Nation last night explaining what it was like when the shooting started and he was right next to the president and the first lady and the press secretary. Cut 10.
So we're a little bit elevated at the head table and we see a ton of different SWAT, tactical, and Secret Service members running into the room, guns drawn, and noticing that right away, this is not the normal type of maybe a tray was dropped, or maybe somebody's having a medical condition, feeling faint of breath, falling, a heart attack, something of that sort that you see at events this large. This is something nefarious and dangerous, and you feel the hairs on your neck starting to lift.
Yeah, and it started to lift. And, you know, he didn't know. He thought it might have been an explosion, cut 11.
And if you watch the video, it's surreal that this was 24 hours ago, was I'm watching and we're understanding. And there's one other person next to me who goes down first. I instinctively see this and I don't think shooter. I'm telling you this just as the way that they were coming in. It didn't look like they were coming to shoot someone or watch for someone who was holding a gun. To me, it appeared as if they were trying to stop someone. And so I thought a bomb was about to go off. That's just, I'm telling you what happened in my mind. And so I look, I just drop down.
Wow. So he did drop down and then he ended up face to face with you know who. Cut 11.
So I get on all fours and drop down because I'm bracing for what I thought would be an explosion. I see at this point next to me, the president, the Secret Service grab him and they're trying to get him to go down and he's going down. And then they kind of more aggressively get on top of him and bring him down. And the most surreal moments potentially of my life are when President Trump goes down about a foot away from me and we are side to side staring into each other's eyes from a foot away looking at each other. And the thought that crosses my mind right then is, oh no, I hope we're not about to die. And adrenaline is just coursing through me because I said to myself, there's no way the Secret Service is forcing the president down for a fire drill or a maybe. And then right at that moment, if you listen in the video, is when I believe we start hearing the shots. Because it's loud and it's distant, but in the room it's so big, you don't know if it's in the room or outside the room. Later I found out it was outside. I did not know that.
And we continue. Cut 13.
I would love to, when I speak to him again, see what he saw, because honestly, I think I was much more scared than he was. He's been through this before. I have never been through this. I don't think you ever get used to a stranger shooting at you and wanting to kill you. But, I mean, he has been through it. He knows the training protocols. I believe that he was very calm and composed. We did not talk or speak at that moment. I think from what I watched, if you looked at him, he had been taken down what I would describe as pretty strongly.
Yes, he fell or he was pushed down. I can't really tell. It doesn't matter. But he was low and out of the way. And he also was reluctant to move. He wanted to see what was happening. And he also recognized some faces. Well, we didn't. We don't know the Secret Service. He knows them. You know, they're all people that have been around him his whole life, around his family. They rotate in. They probably know him personally, use his golf course, whatever. But so it was just to be with a guy you don't know at a time in which could end your life. Was traumatizing. But Oz Perlman, if they are going to come back, I know he'll come back. And I don't know if you've seen this guy, but he is flat out amazing. He does a lot of NFL training camps. He's on our show. You can find him all over our channel. And probably, I mean, I've never seen him not be astounding. And I'm sure he nailed Caroline Levitt's The Name of a New Child. Meanwhile, just a quick announcement. Thanks to Fox Nation and you, we're going to be on the road. Reno, Nevada, May 30th, History, Liberty, and Laughs at the Hawkins Amphitheater. Then in July 11th, Pensacola, Florida, please join me at the Sanger Theater. We're going to bring history to life, be motivational, inspirational. I'll get a chance to meet you. And then in the fall, when the release of my book, Uniting the States, which you can pre-order, it's Red Bank, New Jersey, October 16th. The very next day, October 17th, at the Westbury Music Fair in the Round. That should be amazing. A lot of Fox people will be joining me in both places. November 7th, Clearwater, Florida, at the Ruth Eckerd Hall. And then the next day, we're driving over to Jacksonville, Florida, back to the Florida Theater with a brand new show. Hope to see everybody in person. And then before the show, I get together with everyone, more of an intimate atmosphere. Then Chesterfield, Missouri, in St. Louis, United States, at The Factory. We're going back there, one of the most beautiful theaters you could possibly play at. So go to BrianKilmeade.com and order tickets. Hope to see you all in person. You're listening to The Brian Kilmeade Show. No reason to go anywhere else.